she needed to get her and Nicholas the hell out of London. This was war. This was real. And they were going to die if she didn't make a decision right now.
"Let's double back," Nicholas said. "That square had shelter."
"No," Etta said. "We can make it to the Aldwych station."
"No, the other one is closer,"
he shouted over the sirens.
"We can cut a path around them if we have to."
"I am getting us out of here. I am getting us out of here. I am getting myself home." She grabbed his hand tightly in hers and dragged him forward. Nicholas tried to pull her back around, but Etta wouldn't turn.
"We can make it. We can't lead them to the passage. Ironwood can't know which one we take. We have to lose them."
"We." They had to do it together, or not at all.
"Damn you," he swore.
But when she started running, he did too. It sounded like thunder from a late summer storm, the kind that used to rattle her in her mom's apartment windows, a boom that cracked over the city and echoed against the glass and steel structures. The whistling alone made her eardrums feel as if they were about to split. The high whines fell eerily silent before each tremendous, deafening crash. Her skin prickled, feeling as if it was about to peel away. Etta would never complain about the sound of the passage now. Not ever again. Not after hearing this. Nicholas craned his head up to watch the shapes ripping through the night sky. It looked as though 1,000 black bugs were being released from each plane, all streaming down to the city around them. The eager curiosity she'd seen earlier on his face had vanished. Etta turned. The street was empty behind them.
"They're gone!"
She pushed her legs harder until she felt her ankle turn on a piece of rubble. But Etta didn't stop, and neither did Nicholas. He looped her arm around his neck and carried her forward as they turned onto Catherine Street.
"It's at the end of the road," she gasped out. "I see others. They're going the same way," he said,
the words rumbling in his chest, echoing the plane's thunder.
"We're almost there."
Families, couples, policemen were all converging in front of a building with a red brick facade. A white banner ran along the top, over the arch of windows. First, Piccadilly Railway. Then the smaller lettering below, Aldwych Station. She let out a sharp yes, at the same moment that Nicholas shuddered and said, "Thank God." A man in a dark police uniform stood at the entrance, waving everyone in. They dodged the clothes, bedding, toys, and suitcases that had been dropped in the panicked flight down, and joined the flow of bodies. Just before they were swallowed into the horde, Nicholas shifted her arm, wrapping it around his waist instead. His other arm fixed across her shoulders, drawing them closer, squeezing them between the dozens of people around them, who were all quietly trying to fight their way down an endless series of stairs.
"How far underground are we?"
Nicholas asked, eyeing the pale lights running along the ceiling.
"Very far," Etta said,
hoping the words were more reassuring than they felt. The pounding hadn't stopped, it was only muffled. The world flickered around them as the electricity was tested by the bombing. Sweat poured down her back, and Etta couldn't stop shaking, even as they broke off from some of the others and headed for the eastern track, as Alice had instructed. Some part of Etta had hoped they would be able to just walk to the very end of the platform, jump down onto the track, and slip away into the tunnel. No hassle, no fuss, no questions. But as they came down the last steps and rounded the corner, she could see they had a problem. That problem being the hundreds of others who had already beaten them down there. Londoners had spread out across the platform, even nestling down on the track. The press of humanity filled the air with a damp, sticky warmth. Many of the men and women had taken off their coats and jackets and hung them up along the walls. Someone had even engineered a kind of clothesline at the entrance to the actual track tunnel. They couldn't spend the night here. They couldn't lose that bit of time when the old man's deadline was edging closer by the second. Nicholas's arm tightened around her again as they were gently pushed forward by the people behind them.
"Damn," he swore softly. "Which way did we need to go?"
She pointed to the other end of the track, where rows upon rows of people were curled up on blankets or gathered in circles of friends and families. Many were talking quietly, or trying to entertain the few little kids she saw with toys or books. But most remained close to silent, their faces stoic. Etta had to hand it to them. They were calm. They seemed almost resigned to this, like it was one great bother, instead of a terrible way to die. All right, we'll wait. We can be patient. If Nicholas was aware of the eyes that were tracking their progress along the platform, he didn't show it. They navigated through the crowd until they found an empty space near the end of the platform, under a sign advertising the Paramount Theater's showing of something called I Was an Adventuress, starring someone named Zarina. Nicholas took off the bag and his jacket as Etta lowered herself down onto the patch of concrete, leaning back against the curved wall. She drew her legs up to her chest and hugged them hard, hard enough for her knees to crack. Calm down, she thought. Calm down. But the bombing hadn't stopped, and Etta could almost see how, if one was dropped in just the wrong place overhead, it would mean game over. Not just for her and Nicholas, but for the hundreds of people packed around them like sleeves of wafers. Nicholas rummaged through the bag, producing their lone apple. Etta wasn't hungry, though she hadn't eaten since they'd left New York. Her stomach had turned to stone, throbbing in time with the muscles that still burned from the run. Nicholas glanced at her, concern dragging down the corners of his mouth.
I should have found us water. I'm sorry, Etta.
We'll be fine, she whispered. They'd find some once they went through the next passage.
I have to say, he muttered, leaning back, I am harboring some incredible ill will toward this mother of yours.
Etta wasn't feeling so fond of her at that precise moment either. Even as she was terrified for her, her mind was constantly looping back to that photograph, the way she'd been tied up, the kind of men that were holding her.
Well, Etta said weakly, she always told me a good challenge builds character.
Then we'll have an excess of it, he said dryly.
Conditions on the platform were so tight that they sat shoulder to shoulder, hip to hip, leg to leg. Etta was glad for the solid presence of him, that she could lean into him, now that her nerves seemed poised to sweep her into a full-blown panic attack. She crossed her legs, letting the cool cement press into the exposed skin. None of Oscar's breathing tricks seemed to be working, not when all hell was raining down on the street above. The woman to her right silently prayed. How many hours would they have to sit down here, hoping? It was the 22nd of September. That only left them with 8 more days to find the astrolabe and get back, and they still had no idea how to decipher the other clues. Her breath hitched as panic began to creep into her system. How was Nicholas so calm, so steady, like he'd been through this all before? Maybe he had, in a way. The bombing didn't sound all that different from the pounding cannonade from the ships, the small explosions of each gun. She wanted to ask him, but she couldn't speak, afraid that admitting anything might open the floodgates in her. Everyone was holding it together. She could, too. I wish I could play. Etta craved the distraction, the absolute focus of playing. If she couldn't feel the weight of the instrument in her hands, then she could at least imagine. She closed her eyes and called the music to her. The phantom press of strings against her fingers filled her, for the first time since Alice had died, with a sense of familiar joy. Not the disgust and humiliation she'd felt when she thought about her performance, or the shattering anger and grief at wondering what had happened to Alice's body. If she and her mother would even make it in time for the funeral. For lack of anything better to use, she took her left forearm into her right hand, closing her eyes. She could pretend, just for a few seconds, that her wrist was the neck, her veins the strings. She imagined the bow gliding across her skin, focused on the movements of it. Bach. Bach demanded her concentration. Bach would take her out of this moment.
What are you doing? Nicholas asked.
Playing, she said, not caring how ridiculous it must look and sound to him. Distracting myself.
A man, stretched out on his stomach in front of them, lifted his face up to look out of his book and glance their way curiously. It was perfectly strange timing that a high, clear note broke the odd spell of calm in the station just then. Down toward the center of the platform, an older man had brought out a violin and was working the instrument in slow, mellow song. She recognized it. It wasn't a classical composition, but something that had come scratching out of Oscar's old record player. The sound bloomed around them, like a flower unfurling one petal at a time, carrying across the walls of white tiles with their patterns of black crosses. A passing police officer tilted his hat toward the man. Etta sat up, straining to see him over the heads between them. She had, however, no trouble seeing the young couple that was dancing in their few feet of allotted space. The man's arm was locked around her waist, and he took her hand in his. The woman laughed, looking around them nervously, but followed his slow, rocking movements, resting her head against his shoulder. Nicholas watched them, entranced. Etta thought for sure he'd say something about how scandalous it was for them to be dancing so close together. "That's beautiful," she said. He turned to her.
"Would you like me to go and take that violin for you? I'd gladly fight whatever angry mob rises up if it might make you smile."
Her heart just about burst at that. "Be brave. I would only want to play it for you." He turned slowly, as if taking the time to assemble some sort of expression or response. But she didn't want there to be any mistake, any way for him to dismiss or misunderstand her words. If she was wrong and he wanted nothing more between them, she would pull back. But now she just wanted to be brave. Her hand came to rest on top of his, and despite all of his obvious strength, the shields he threw up to protect the privacy of his mind, she felt his fingers slide through hers. The lights flickered again, sending her attention and her heart shooting upward. The banging was loud, like hands slamming down directly on top of them. A boy started wailing, and the sound moved like a wave through the other kids. The dancers stopped dancing, but the older gentleman didn't stop playing until the lights blinked out completely, leaving them in pitch black. Etta couldn't stop shivering. She bit the inside of her mouth and drew blood. The darkness seemed to shudder and rock around them, and whatever terror she'd managed to bottle up broke free. "I don't want to die down here. I don't want to disappear. I have to get home. Mom. Mom is going to die, and it's my fault." Hot tears rolled down her cheeks, and she hiccuped as she tried to take in air. "Etta," Nicholas said, close to her ear. He shifted, drawing her closer. She pressed her face against the slope of skin between his neck and shoulder, and felt a hand weave through her hair, pulling it back from where strands were sticking to her wet cheeks. "Shh, Etta. We're safe," he said. "The battle's ours, pirate. They'll strike their colors, and it will pass." She breathed in the sea salt that always seemed to cling to his skin, no matter how far from the ocean he was. Her mind felt foggy, her face raw, as his hand slipped away from her face and glided down her arm. With an aching tenderness, he laced his fingers through hers and brought them to his other arm, resting upturned in his lap. He'd rolled the sleeve up, and she felt a shock of hot skin against her fingertips as he pressed her hand there.
"Play me something."
"What?"
Etta whispered. "Something that'll lift us out of here."
His fingers unhooked from hers, following that same path up her arm, and then back down it again. The feeling was so distracting, so good, so sweet against her clammy skin. She didn't choose a piece from her repertoire. Etta gave herself over to the notes that started streaming through her mind, rising from somewhere deep inside of her. The melody of her heart had no name. It was quick and light. It rolled with the waves, falling as the breath left his chest, rising as he inhaled. It was the rain sliding down the glass, the fog spreading its fingers over the water, the creaking of a ship's great body, the secrets whispered by the wind, and the unseen life that moved below. It was the flame of one last candle. Nicholas's arm was a map of hard muscles and delicate sinews, heartbreakingly perfect. She wondered if he could hear her humming the piece against his skin over the droning roars of her head. Maybe. His free hand skimmed up her skin, leaving a trail of sparks in its wake. With the world blacked out around them, she could catalog all of her other senses, capture this moment in the warm darkness forever. He brushed back the loose hair across her forehead, his breath hitching as she turned her face up. Soft lips found her cheek, the corner of her lips, her jaw, and she knew it had to be the same for him, that they'd never been so aware of another person in their entire lives. She released his arm, and he drew it up around her, guiding both of them down so they were on their sides, their heads cushioned by the bag, his jacket drawn over them. Etta understood that here, in the darkness, they'd found a place beyond rules, a place that hung somewhere between the past and the future. This was a single moment of possibility. The clattering of the attack from above faded as he rested his forehead against hers, his thumb lightly stroking a bruise on her cheek. She traced his face, the straight nose, the high, proud cheekbones, the full curve of his lips. His hand caught her there, taking it in his own. He pressed a hard, almost despairing kiss to it. But when she tilted her face up, half desperate with longing, her blood racing, Nicholas pulled back. And although Etta could feel him beside her, his heart pounding, his ragged breath, it was as if he had disappeared into the thundering dark. 13. The battle exploded around him with a ferocity that left him gasping. Nicholas had kept an eye on the horizon to the west, where steel clouds had begun to swirl, as if God himself was stirring the pot. The skies around him were cast in shades of darkness that left his guts coiled in anticipation. He turned, poised to begin the process of readying the ship to weather the storm, and the crew was gone. Every last one of them. Chase's name tore out of his throat as he ran toward the bow of the ship, the sound of his footsteps lost to the shrieking winds. The sails snapped and fluttered above him in warning. A movement caught his eye. There was someone on his ship after all. His back was turned, but there was no mistaking the dark curls rising on each brutal breeze, the steady stance, the hands clasped behind his back. "Julian," he called. But, by God, how was he alive? Had he survived the fall? They needed to get back to port, back to New York. The other ship appeared like a ghost, gliding through the misty, shadowed waters around them. He had less than a moment to suck in a shocked breath before she fired at broadside. Nicholas felt the ship tear apart beneath him as if it were his own skin, his own bones shattered into a thousand jagged fragments. "Julian!" he screamed as the fire and debris exploded around him, trapping him in a blaze of suffocating fire, a swarm of splinters. And all the while, the cannonade never slowed, never stopped. The intensity burned the hair from his face, left him with nothing but scalding white behind his eyelids. He let out a hoarse cry as he was knocked off his feet. The ship dipped sharply to the right, a terrifying slant that could only mean one thing. She was taking on water, and he would drown. Blind, burned, alone. And then, the silence. It was the suddenness of it that finally woke Nicholas from heavy, dream-laced sleep, dragging him up by the scruff of his neck into awareness. Exhaustion clung to his mind like a barnacle, unable to let logic in. Pure, unyielding panic rushed in like a sweeping wave, forcing him to roll away from the soft warmth he'd been curled around. The white tiles, the hundreds of brown, blue, red, black lumps of blankets around him. People. Nicholas sat straight up, pressing his back into the wall behind him. He scrubbed his fist against his eyes, trying to slow the embarrassing way his heart was pounding in his chest. "You know where you are." He did. London. 20th century. War. This was a transportation tunnel. For a train. The underground. Nicholas blew out a sigh, wiping the crust of sleep from his eyes. The overhead lights flickered like candle flames dancing in the breeze. He cocked his head, listening to the strange sound they produced, somewhere between a hum and a frantic clicking, like the cicadas in the southern colonies. Electricity. It had been so long since he'd had the privilege of it, and even when he had never seen the abundance of this era. Julian had been the one to introduce him to it, the one who chuckled as Nicholas investigated his first light bulb. Nicholas had managed to push the memory of his half-brother to the very edge of his thoughts for years, where the regret could not infect his hope for the future. But traveling and Julian were inexorably tied together. Julian was the sole reason he'd gone through the passages at all. At first he'd thought that he was there to ensure that Ironwood's remaining revivals could not touch him, that he was a protector, a role in which he could take immense pride. In actuality, he'd found himself attending to his brother's clothing, doing the washing and mending as if he were a valet. He saw to Julian's mercurial needs and managed his wild swinging moods. Even as a traveler, he had been a servant, a slave to Ironwood's will. "I don't need a protector," the girl had said. "I need a partner." The past few hours had proven that she did, in fact, need a protector. But partner, this was something he had never thought to hope for. He spent another moment collecting his nerves before looking back down at the girl sleeping beside him. The air in his lungs and nose was tinged with the smell of roses, as though he'd spent hours with his face buried in her mass of unruly blonde hair. Before he could think about why it was unwise, ruminate on what a blackguard he was for taking advantage of the girl in the darkness, he reached over and gently brushed that same hair back from her face. In some ways, each time he looked at her, it was as if he was seeing her for the first time on the deck of the Ardent. The symptoms of this sickness were unmistakable. The sharp dive of his heart as it dropped, recovering a moment too late. The tightness in his chest, the way his fingers seemed to curl instinctively, as if wondering how it would feel to weave them in her hair. He knew lust. He'd been consumed by its burn too many times. But Nicholas knew the ways to appease it, how to avoid the tangle of attachment, to leave content and calm and ready to return to the ship. As he'd held her last night, he had genuinely believed the result would be the same. Touching her would answer his lingering doubts about whether her skin could possibly be as soft as he imagined. Giving in to the pounding need in his head to comfort her would be acceptable, just this once, when they could not be seen or judged for it. Instead, each second he spent breathing her breath, running his hands along her face, fighting the temptation of her lips. It only fed the burn in his chest. He wanted to believe that he had done it because she'd needed comfort, or at least distraction. He wanted to believe it was because being a stranger to this time had left him feeling unsettled. He wanted to believe that their lives could have ended at any moment, and there had been only this one chance left. But the truth was, Nicholas had held her because he wanted to. He hadn't thought about her reputation, or what anyone else might have cared to think. He'd taken what he wanted, and to hell with everyone else. Nicholas felt a rueful smile spread across his face, and a curse be on him for it, because now he knew her. She'd shown him her mind, and she'd opened up her heart, and now he knew the taste of her tears. And he was wrecked. He clung to his willpower the way a man clings to battered remains of flotsam. It was hard enough to stay afloat, to remind himself of the important facts that remained, when she was so soft and warm and alive in his hands. Could he kiss her, knowing that he was on the very verge of betraying her and ensuring that the astrolabe got back to Ironwood? Could he kiss her, knowing she must return to her time and he must remain in his? The vilification they would face if she were to come back with him to his time, and they were made to deal with the cruel laws of the colonies. Could he kiss her, knowing she might not burn the same way he did? From the moment he had been exiled, Nicholas had used the dream of owning a ship as ballast to weather the storm of guilt and anger and devastation. He had learned, again, to swallow the limitations of his era's society, even if he never fully accepted them. Traveling with her had stirred up thoughts inside of him that he had been so very careful not to touch. It gave him ideas of a dangerous nature. What would life be like if he did not return to his time? If, rather than return the astrolabe to Ironwood, they spent their lives like pilgrims, moving through lands and centuries until they found one in which they could be safe, one that suited their needs. When two people didn't belong to the era they were in, did they have to follow anyone's expectations besides their own? Except, of course, she's desperate to save her mother and go home. And he was desperate to see his own ambitions through. It was nothing more than a thought that had gone rogue, spiraled out of his control. What Nicholas wanted was his ship, multiple ones at that. To live a life without restraints, and to be rid of his family and their scheming forever. And surely, Etta would not be safe under any circumstances if he didn't bring the astrolabe to Ironwood, would she? Not truly. Perhaps one day she might see this and come to terms with his deception. It was all too easy to be carried off by the wild, baseless theories. The old man merely wanted to expand his flock, find more servants. And while their departure through the passage had been sudden and unexpected,
He did not doubt that all would be forgiven, so long as he gave Ironwood what he wanted. But there had been a moment, as Alice and Etta had dissected Ironwood's possible intentions, when the confession had nearly tumbled off his tongue. You could keep her. The words slithered through his mind, bringing a host of images with them that filled his heart with a savage kind of joy. When had it become his policy to give up his prizes? When had Nicholas ever given up a treasure that was rightfully won? We were made for each other. Once the thought was there, it clung to him like a second skin, near impossible to scrub away. Because no, of course they weren't. They were two ships sailing in opposite directions, having met for a short time in the middle of the voyage, and he could no sooner keep her than capture the wind. Nor would he insult her by trying, let alone think it was possible. When the time came, they would continue on as they had before. She would be with her family, safe. He would have his ship, be in full control of his fate, the only thing he'd ever truly wanted for himself. This would be a mild disappointment in an otherwise successful life. He would not surrender to the disaster of loving her. In time, the pain would pass. But he would regret the loss, the simplicity. Neither of them had to work for the other's regard, nor did they make the other feel as if they had to. It struck him as very peculiar, given his somewhat limited exposure to future centuries, that this girl fit so well beside him, that they understood each other so very well. Life had shown him that there were only two ways he could gain something, through the kindness and pity of others, or by taking it through sheer force of will. Why had this arrived in such a different manner? He looked around him again, at the spread of sleeping families, husbands and wives, friends. How uncomplicated they made it seem. The couple that had danced together hours before, how freely they could hold and touch one another, live in a moment they created. Enough, he ordered himself. This is a job. She is my companion in it. The stakes were too high for either of them to be distracted by feelings. Nicholas searched for the uniformed man he'd seen walking along the edge of the raised platform the night before, and found him asleep on the steps they'd used to come down. Here and there were patches of space scattered among the sleeping Londoners. Some must have left at the end of the air raid and gone to whatever was left of their homes. He heaved himself up into a crouch, trying to avoid thinking about the city's destruction. The inhuman sounds of the flying machines and the shelling hadn't been half as terrible as the thought of what might have happened if they hadn't run as fast as they did, if the firestorm had been dropped on top of them. They needed to leave this era, quickly. The guardians of this time would be up and searching for them by now. He reached over, his finger hesitating a moment before stroking at his cheek to wake her. She shifted, stretching her legs out, and drew his jacket over her with a soft sigh. Nicholas put a hand on her shoulder and shook it until her eyes blinked open. She stared, all warm and rumpled by sleep, and his reason for waking her almost flew out of his head. "What are you?" she mumbled. He held a finger up to his lips as he stood, sliding the leather bag over his shoulder. Etta took the hand he offered to pull herself up off the ground, swaying. Holding her steady, Nicholas wrapped his jacket over her shoulders. It was only after they started to make their way along the edge of the track, skirting the sleeping Londoners, that he realized he was still holding her hand. Nicholas gestured toward the other end of the raised platform, and Etta nodded. He was headed the right way then. Good. Once he lost sight of the sky, it felt impossible to tell north from south, east from west. He found the experience of being underground about as pleasant as being blown to bits, like the ship in his dream. There was something unnatural about not being able to feel the sunlight on your skin in the morning. The platform ended abruptly. He was forced to release Etta's hand and jump down onto the tracks. His shoes butted up against the raised metal beams running along the ground. Etta sat on the edge of the strange, cold, gray stone ledge, and slid down into the dark with him, careful to avoid the clusters of families packed between the tracks. Determination and focus sharpened Etta's features in the glow of the lights. She turned toward the dark tunnel and led the way. The air smelled vaguely of fire. His frown deepened, a new uneasiness stirring in him. He kept close to Etta, forcing her to slow her pace. When he turned, there was a man leaning over the platform,
peering down the tunnel. At first he thought the man had skin darker than his own, but the truth came like a swift blow. The man's face was stained with soot, but his features were recognizable. He'd shot at them the night before as they'd run toward the station. How the bloody hell had he found them already?
"One of the thorns," he said. "We need to move faster."
"I see something," she said. There was a light up ahead, a break in the tunnel. "It must be the next station. We're getting close." Without breaking his stride, Nicholas reached into the bag and pulled out the harmonica. He put the instrument to his lips and blew softly. The note was nothing but a faint rasp of sound. In return, they were showered with such clapping thunder and monstrous shrieks that Etta instinctively pulled back against him, trying to escape it. They had come up just short of what had to be the Elgin Marbles. Indeed, he saw the top of a white chiseled head over its wooden shelter, the lifeless eyes tracking their path through the thick darkness.
"Stop!" the man cried. "Never."
"There! Right there!" She pointed toward the wall, where the air seemed to ripple in the darkness. The rattling screams reached a fevered state, making the blood pound inside of his head as he crossed through first, Etta at his back. The momentum launched him out through the gate at the other end of the passage. He felt his breath catch, the hammering pulse of his heart. The world dissolved into pure darkness, the squeeze of air around him popping the bones in his stiff back. And as quickly as he had leapt into it, Nicholas was spat out through the other side. Birds and insects screeched from their perches in the fleshy green trees and brush around him. There was always a moment of blindness as his eyes adjusted to being inundated with light. He pressed his face against the wet earth, trying to clear the fog in his mind. No sooner had he started to get up when a weight crashed into his back and sent him sprawling down into the mud again.
"Sorry,"
Etta gasped, rolling off him.
"Ow!"
He sat up, his vision swinging back toward the passage's entrance. When it became clear that the other man wasn't about to follow them through, that if he was indeed a thorn, he was a guardian rather than a traveler, Nicholas began to look beyond it. Jungle. A vast, thick shield of green and brown around him. The air was heavy with the contradictory scents of rotting vegetation and floral blooms, lit green by the screen of bright leaves and tangle of thin branches overhead.
"Are you all right?"
he asked, the words scratching out of his dry throat.
"Etta."
She was flat on her back, the sky blue dress splattered with mud. Before he could stop himself, he began to pluck the long green leaves out of her hair, flicking them away as the girl groaned, shaking madly.
"You're all right," he told her. "Look at me. Just for a moment. Just a moment, pirate."
It had taken him at least 5 trips through the passages during his training before he'd worked the last of the traveler sickness out of his system. He knew too well how she was feeling. The weakness, the way every sound was battering her skull, the blood that was turning to ice in her veins. Etta opened her eyes, but they were unfocused. A soft sigh escaped her lips, and her eyelids fluttered shut.
"It's fine," she said. "Just need... moment."
They didn't have a moment, and they wouldn't until he figured out where the passage had brought them, and whether more guardians were near. The man in London would report what he'd seen to any nearby traveler, and he or she would be sent to follow them. They'd need to find the next passage immediately, and be gone before they could be tracked again. Nicholas would bring Ironwood his damned astrolabe, but he wished to do so on his own terms, and keep Etta well out of Ironwood's grasp. He needed to keep her from sensing that this journey would have a very different end than the one she imagined. He looked down at her grimacing face, and swallowed the burn of bile in his throat. After another long look around to ensure there was no one nearby, and that the only immediate threats were hunger and dehydration, Nicholas gathered her up into his arms and began to walk. There was no trail, no evidence of human touch. He strained his ears, trying to hear above the rattle and buzz of the insects, and there, he heard what he hoped was the sound of rushing water. Etta's weight felt good and solid in his arms, but the feel of her in his arms, Nicholas thought with some uneasiness, was getting a bit too familiar. He stepped over the powerful arm of a root jutting up out of the soft soil.
He let the branches blocking their way do what they would to his neck and face, and did the best he could to shield Etta.
Where?
She asked, already coming around. He fought a smile. Next time would be easier on her then.
Not entirely sure, to tell you the truth, he said.
Put me down, she said. I can walk, I promise. His hands tightened around her waist, her legs. The air had grown warm, and he knew he must smell worse than whatever ungodly, rotting stench the jungle was belching out. But reluctance tugged at him even as he set her down on her feet. She can look after herself. Etta knew herself well enough to know what she could and couldn't fight through. But that, of course, didn't preclude him wanting to take care of her. Etta looked around, taking in the knot of green foliage, the way the canopy shielded them from the sun's glare.
Well, this is different.
He snorted. Come, let's see what we can find in the way of water and food.
His ears hadn't failed him. There was a stream nearby, and it moved quickly enough for him to feel mildly comfortable drinking it. Whenever he and Julian had tried to survive in the wild, they had carried packs stuffed with supplies, pots for boiling water and cooking, blankets for freezing nights. There had been matches to start fires, hooks and lines for fishing. It had been Hall who'd taught him how to survive with none of these things. He had a small knife he'd carried with him from New York. That would have to be enough.
Wait here a moment,
he said, gesturing toward a stone on the bank of the stream.
I'll be right back. Shout if you see or hear anything.
She nodded, distracted by something in the distance. He walked back the way he had come, veering right when he saw a tower of pale green out of the corner of his eye. Bananas. None of them ripe, but food all the same. He sent up a prayer of gratitude to whoever might be listening as he began to pull them from the tree and stow them in the bag. The most pressing issue now was finding some kind of container in which to boil water, and locating wood and brush that were dry enough to strike up a fire. He ran a hand along the spine of a downed tree, considering. Using his knife, he cut away a section of it and brushed off the dirt and insects. The tree was mostly hollowed out inside, and if he carved it right, it could be used as a small bowl. Nicholas stripped off his wilted shirt, surprised to find it was already damp with sweat as he stowed it in his bag. The air had taken on the quality of the swamps down south in the colonies, pregnant with the potential for a raging storm. Perhaps they wouldn't need to boil water at all, only catch it. His knife chipped and cut away at the tree, and Nicholas lost himself in the good feeling of accomplishment, stopping only to relieve himself in the privacy of the leaves and eat half of a banana. He felt better for all of it, and knew she would too, once he gave her something to fill her stomach. But when he returned to the small stream, Etta was nowhere to be found. Disappeared. He closed his eyes, which was a mistake. All he saw was Julian's face, how he'd looked just as he was swallowed by mist and distance.
Etta! He called, his voice cracking. Etta!
Gone. Had she slipped somewhere? Fallen? Drowned? Panic flared in him, white-hot, leaving him dizzy with it. He charged around the clearing, straining his ears for any hint of her footsteps, any sign of her. He had a feeling Etta hadn't shown him whatever her true intentions were with the astrolabe, how she wanted to confront Ironwood. But she wouldn't have just left, would she? Gone on ahead. She did it before, a cruel part of his mind whispered. In New York. The brush behind him rustled and Etta stumbled back out, eyes wide.
What is it? What's wrong?
For a moment, the residual terror was enough to choke him, make his heart start pounding in his chest. Her hair was mussed, and there was a streak of dirt across her cheek that matched the bruise and scratch on the other. She straightened the skirt of her dress, and he had a sense of why she had momentarily disappeared.
"I," he managed to get out. "I told you to stay put."
Her brow furrowed at his anger, as if she couldn't possibly understand why wandering off in the middle of a jungle could be dangerous.
"You agreed,"
he said, feeling ludicrous, but a fire was blazing in his chest that he couldn't seem to put out.
"Okay," she said slowly.
"I'm sorry."
"You're sorry."
Nicholas knew he should accept it, that he should move on to the business of starting a fire, but he couldn't bring himself to move past the fear just yet.
What if something had happened? How would I have found you? When I ask you to do something, please endeavor to listen to me.
She rose to her full height, and for the first time he noticed that she'd removed her jacket and was cradling something in it. A severed head. Of a statue. His heart settled back into its rightful place as he took in its serene smile. It made a perfect counterpoint to the look of irritation on her face as she set it down.
I was going to say, I think I know where we are, but since you clearly know everything, I'll let you figure it out for yourself.
Etta stormed along the stream. Nicholas waited for her to come back and laugh after a moment, so the band of tightness around his chest would fray enough for him to breathe again. Only she didn't, of course. She tripped, but caught herself handily, against... Was that a stone wall? It was. More than that, there were steps, and more statues that had been knocked over or absorbed into the thick bodies of trees. Most of these stone figures bore a similar face to the one Etta had found, but some had been left with no features at all. Time, and the forces of the jungle, had worn them away. The thunder that shattered the jungle brought her up short, made her press her hands to her ears. The insects and birds became almost frantic, the latter launching themselves from the trees at the first small drops of rain.
"Oh, my God!" Etta gasped, turning to look back at him.
Her arm was outstretched, pointing at something orange and white a short distance away, half hidden by foliage. Nicholas's eyes were fixed only on what was at her feet, and watched as its head rose up out of the mud behind her, scales glinting and slick as its hood flattened out. She must have stepped right on it and been none the wiser.
Don't move.
Terror thrummed inside of him, fast and desperate, as another burst of thunder exploded over their heads. Etta started to step back, turning to look at him, and the snake bobbed in the air, poised to strike.
Don't move!
He didn't trust his aim with the knife just then. Any slip, any gust of wind, and the blade would be in her leg and not in the damned snake. Before he could question himself, the revolver was in his hand. The snake lashed forward, and he fired.
Angkor, 1685.
14. There was a small explosion behind Etta, an instant before heat seared the back of her left calf, and she was thrown forward onto her hands and knees. She looked up in time to see the tiger's tail flash as it turned and ran deeper into the trees. Her ears were ringing, aching, as she turned around and saw the head of a cobra staring up at her, a short distance away from the long, coiled muscle of its body. Both the head and the body were still moving. Etta stared at it, unable to so much as feel the rain that suddenly burst down, shaking the leaves, pounding the mud. Nicholas stood a few feet back, the revolver still in his hand, looking as if he'd been the one shot, not the snake. Etta reached down, touching her left calf muscle and coming away with blood. She stared at it long enough that the rain began to wash it away, long enough for Nicholas to snap out of his own shock. He rushed forward, kicking the snake aside.
"Did it bite you?"
He took her leg in his hand, trying to see for himself, and she was right. It was shaking.
"Etta, did it bite you?"
"No." But on its path to the snake, the bullet had grazed her skin, cutting close enough to leave a red, angry mark. She had been that close to getting bitten, and she hadn't had any idea.
"Christ," he said, pressing his hand against it.
He tore the sleeve off the jacket she'd been carrying and dug through the bag for the scissors. As gently as he could, he dabbed the blood away and wrapped her leg with another, cleaner strip of fabric. "But where is the tiger?" Etta wondered. When she'd spotted it, at first she had felt surprised and delighted. Its luminous eyes had tracked their progress forward with keen interest. Only then had she realized that there was no barrier between them. Nicholas's hands were smoothing down her wet hair, and kept moving over her shoulders, down her arms, back up again to cup her face. He slowly came into focus, and she realized he'd been speaking to her this whole time.
"Can you stand?" he asked her.
The ground had turned into a river of mud beneath them, and she was eager to get out of it. She nodded, accepting his help up, and gingerly tested whether or not she could bear to put weight on her leg. Her hand stayed on his bare shoulders as she looked up into his face.
"All right,"
he asked, his voice still sounding odd to her ears. Etta nodded again. Standing was easy, speaking was not.
Do you want to walk?
She nodded, hugging her arms to her chest. Nicholas nudged them forward, but a thought spun in Etta's mind and she tugged him back.
Wait, we should take it.
It, he repeated. The snake.
Yeah.
Etta shook off the last bit of shock blanketing her mind.
What if we need to eat it? Shouldn't we take it with us?
Thinking about this further, she added, maybe not the head, though. Flanked by a curtain of green that glowed vibrantly, even in the silver overcast light, with rain pouring down over his face, his shoulders, the scars that crisscrossed over his chest, Nicholas blinked and started to laugh. He tilted his head back, catching the rain across his face, and when he finally leaned down to kiss her, the sweetness of it lingered on his lips. It seemed to end before it even began. He pulled back, looking equally abashed and afraid, studying her face. Her hands itched to smooth the lines of worry away from his forehead, from around his beautiful dark eyes. But he wasn't the type to like being soothed. She knew that. And she also knew that this concern was more than just stupid 18th-century propriety. They were beyond that now. She set her shoulders back, meeting his gaze with a challenge.
You call that a kiss?
One corner of his mouth quirked up.
We haven't time for a proper one, pirate. Now tell me, where precisely are we?
At some point between the time when Nicholas had left to do whatever it was that required him to be shirtless, and her finding the Buddha statue's decapitated head, a suspicion had begun to take root in the back of her mind. And as she'd walked, glimpsing the dark peaks of the temple in the distance, she'd had a single moment of relief at having been right, before the anger began to pump through her again. New York, London, and now Cambodia. It was too much to be a coincidence. She'd taken out the letter, reading the first clue they'd been able to ignore, as it came before the passage in New York. Rise and enter the lair, where the darkness gives you your stripes. It must mean the Taksang Palphug Monastery in Bhutan, called the Tiger's Lair or the Tiger's Nest, where her mother claimed to have gone into one of the caves to meditate on what to do with her life, which now seemed, in a word, unlikely. Her mother had told her how to decipher the letter. She told her any number of times, under the guise of bedtime stories, about her life and adventures. She'd even painted the scenes, hanging them on the wall of the living room in the correct order, which made Etta feel like an idiot for not making the connection right away. Each clue had been carefully disguised to hide the reality of her life as a traveler. Each was hiding in plain sight. Now Etta was sure that the painting of the British Museum hadn't been meant to lead her to the museum, but to the painting's other subject, Alice. And Etta was willing to bet that, if she double-checked, she'd find that her mother's supposed first apartment in the city, the one she'd painted to show a glimpse of the lights of Midtown East through one of the windows, was in the same location as the Dove Tavern.
Are you listening, Etta? Etta, are you paying attention? Let me tell you a story.
Rose had planted the seeds, watered them again and again, by repeating the stories over the years. She had given Etta what she needed to find the astrolabe. Etta only had to make the connection. Etta had never been to the Tiger's Nest, let alone Bhutan, but she knew someone beside her mother who had. She and Nicholas walked side by side, her eyes trained on the ground, his on the path in front of them, until more of the dark stones and statues rose out of the foliage and marked their path forward. From her mother's apparently half-true stories, Etta knew that both cities, Angkor Wat and their present location, Angkor Thom, had, in her time, been largely cleared of the jungle's ever-reaching overgrowth to allow for tourists to explore the spread of temples and structures. But whatever year or era they were in, it was clear it was after it had been abandoned by the Khmer Empire, but before it had come to the attention of Western civilization.
"We'll need to swim," Nicholas said, the first words he'd uttered in nearly an hour.
They'd come upon what Etta thought might have been part of the moat that surrounded the remains of the Grand City. The moat had naturally filled up with earth and wildlife over the years, but with the rain lashing down around them, the water level was high enough that they couldn't wade their way across.
"No, my mom talked about some kind of a bridge, at the southern gate, I think. Etta said. She doubted it looked anything like the modern causeway that existed in her era, but it was worth finding to avoid whatever was living in the moat. To fill the silence and stop thinking about the way the rain made the trees rattle like angry snakes, Etta asked, "Where did you travel with Julian?"
"Here and there."
All right. Julian was still off limits, and she wouldn't press him, not when it was clearly still painful. But Etta was incredibly curious about that sliver of time in his life. "I think you were close to getting on the right trail to the astrolabe," she told him. "I'm not sure if you were in the right year, but I'm almost positive the first clue refers to the tiger's nest. And that's where Julian died, right?" Nicholas ran a hand back over his short hair and nodded. Etta's fingers twisted around one another. "It's my mom's fault, isn't it? Everything. You traveling with him, his death.
I can forgive your mother for doing what she believed to be right, even if her methods were questionable and a damned pain," he said. "But if we trace the blame back to its roots, there's only Ironwood at fault."
"Always Ironwood."
"I'm not sure where or how to begin," he said, holding a branch out of her way.
Nicholas searched for the words.
"Julian and I were sent to Bhutan because the old man had found records that a monk once sighted a young blonde woman in one of the meditation caves, one who never emerged from it again. We thought for certain it would be another fruitless trip. Over the years, the search took us everywhere, from Mexico to India, to what I think you'd know as Alaska."
Etta nodded.
It's not such an easy thing to discuss," he said,
his low voice drowned out for a moment by the cracking of thunder.
"For a time, I was blind to the real role I was playing. I told myself I wasn't there as Julian's servant, but as a brother, a friend, and a protector. I think he did see me as a confidant, but I'm afraid I have too much pride. The realization that I was actually there to play valet festered in me, made me resent him. Just before he died, I told him that I didn't want to travel any longer. I wanted out of the trap of servitude again. Ironwood had promised me status if I returned to the arms of the family, promised me wonder, adventure, all the things that sound exciting to a boy of 14. But I was never given freedom. I was issued orders. I did not receive the full training, or the locations of all the passages you see. I wonder now if Ironwood feared I'd escape through them and somehow disappear."
She did see. Cyrus was a masterful manipulator. He would probably have promised to lasso the moon and bring it down to Nicholas in order to get him to travel with Julian.
"I wanted to make those choices again, build my own life, feel like I was at its helm again, the way I only felt with the halls when I sailed with the captain."
"What did Julian say when you told him you wanted out?" she asked.
Nicholas was silent a long while. "He told me there was a contract I'd signed, and not a single drop of shared blood would compel any of the Ironwoods to break it. He said it was my purpose, one way or another, that it was the order of things. Terribly sorry, old chap, and all of that. I don't believe he had a black heart in him. He'd only been poisoned with these justifications like the rest of them."
Etta itched to take his hand, but by the way his shoulders were bunched, she wasn't sure he wanted to be touched.
"I realized my mistake. I'd been planning to slip away from the family once we returned to the 18th century, to fall back into place in my own natural timeline. And I thought I might be able to, after we returned from..."
He trailed off again.
"Does Sophia still believe I let him fall?"
Etta winced, giving him his answer. "I told her that was impossible."
"Is it?"
he said, brushing a branch out of the way.
"I don't blame her. The whole family must have known I was desperate to escape my contract of service. Exile is a rather neat, if extreme, method of accomplishing just that. I've even wondered if something in me let him fall, knowing what the consequences would be."
She shook her head.
"No.
And for what it's worth, Sophia does recognize it was an accident."
"But she does blame me," he finished. "I blame myself. And I'm the fool. Because in spite of everything, he was my brother. I never saw him as anything less, or cared for him less than Chase, who is my brother in everything but blood. And it clearly wasn't the same for him."
She tried to remember what Sophia had said,
that Julian had insisted he and everyone else should think of Nicholas as his brother. But words must have meant very little when he clearly hadn't demonstrated any of those feelings. "That doesn't make you a fool," Etta huffed, wiping her sopping wet hair out of her face. "You deserve to be loved and treated with respect." If he heard her, Nicholas didn't acknowledge it. He turned his face up to the rain for a moment, then continued forward in silence.
"I should have saved him," he said after a long while. "When I came back to find that you'd gone, it brought me back to that moment on the mountain. It gripped me and wouldn't let me go, even after I saw that you were all right."
A panic attack, she wondered. Or an echo of a terrible memory. That would explain the overreaction.
"All that's left in the end is the certainty that I can't protect you from every small thing, and it's difficult to accept," he said. "But I am truly very sorry for the things I said."
"It drives me crazy to be treated like a child," she told him. "I know that wasn't your intention, and I know things are different in your time, but almost nothing gets my temper going faster." He nodded.
"I know. It was irrational."
Etta shrugged. "I'm no stranger to irrational thoughts, believe me. I spent the better half of my life secretly convinced I was a mistake my mom regretted bringing into the world, and that's why she was so distant. Hard-hearted and impossible to please. But I know that's not true. When I was younger, she was very different. And she's given me everything I've ever needed. Except, of course, for the truth about traveling." Etta looked over at him, meeting Nicholas's gaze. "I've never told anyone that before. I'm not sure I've even let myself put that feeling into words before, even in my own head."
"And now that you know the truth," he began.
Etta, who had been navigating through pockets of sinking mud and rivulets of water, caught a flash of bright color out of the corner of her eye. Without warning, she crouched and tugged him down with her. Nicholas landed on his knees with a surprised grunt. Etta's attention sharpened, focusing on a point in front of them, as she rose slightly to peer over the brush. They'd been walking along the edge of the moat, following the walls of the city the best they could, even as the jungle did such an excellent job of disguising it. But now Etta caught a flash of something new. She leaned forward, parting the tangle of leaves and limbs in front of her. Ochre cloth. Movement. Men. It took her a moment to place what she was looking at. In her time, Buddhist monks wore brightly colored robes that ranged in color from saffron to a kind of burnt tangerine. These were a duller yellow, stained with splatters of mud. They clung to the men as they took shelter beneath the looming gate on the opposite side of a crumbling bridge.
"I suppose that's the gate with the bridge you spoke of," he said,
close to her ear. She nodded. It seemed to be the only one with a pathway across the moat that was still standing, but even it looked like it was slowly being pulled apart by the jungle. The monks seemed to be discussing what to do. One of them waved his hands toward the jungle, where they were hiding, and Etta and Nicholas flattened against the ground.
"We can't just go, can we?" she whispered.
He raised his brows.
"Do either of us look like we might reasonably belong here, that there's a logical explanation for our presence?"
"Okay, fair point. If time-traveling was the art of blending in, she supposed it might be a little difficult to explain their appearance and clothing in the jungles of Cambodia."
"We aren't traveling with a guardian who could explain away our presence," Nicholas continued, his voice low. "And if they record seeing us, and that record survives..."
"It would change history. A small ripple, maybe, but..." Etta wasn't willing to risk either of their futures. She couldn't say how long they waited, long enough that as she leaned against Nicholas, pressing a cheek against his bare shoulder, she started to nod off. It was the sound of voices that pulled her out of her exhausted haze. The warm, solid weight next to her shoulder slipped away as Nicholas sat up. He tracked their progress as the monks left the shelter of the gate and made their way out onto the bridge. Etta rubbed her face, listening to their quiet murmuring and their footsteps through the damp, sucking jungle. She watched them until they found some sort of path, and the foliage swallowed them up. There had been 10 in all. Nicholas waited a few moments to see if more were leaving the confines of the city, trailing after the first group. When he seemed sure that there were not, he helped her up. Etta put some weight on her aching leg.
"It's all right," she promised when he caught a sharp, worried glance toward her. She could handle it.
Your mother must